House That Was by Graham McNeil. Read by Gareth Armstrong. Chapter 1. Who will be the last to die? Honorius Luciel's name is entered in the operational records as the first, but who will be the last? The treachery orchestrated by the War Master began with the death of an ultramarine, but Captain Remus Ventanus of the 4th Company has sworn that it will end with the death of a word-bearer. Not one of their rag-cloaked rabble of cultist brotherhoods, not one of the skinless abominations dragged from the Empyrean, but with a warrior of the 17th Legion. Ventanus has marked a strip of oath paper with his angular handwriting to that effect. Sidance and Barker bore witness to this, and Celoton affixed the wax-sealed strip to the hilt of his gladius. Ventanus will be the one to drag the last of Lorgar's sons to the service of Kalth, and tear his armour from him before throwing the bastard to the irradiated ground. He will wait and watch as the caustic rays from the poisoned sun burn the flesh from the word-bearer's bones, as layer after layer of skin blackens and drifts away like cinders. The toxic air will scald the traitor's throat, silencing his screams and causing him to retch up the frothing, disintegrating remains of his lungs. And just at the instant before the sun's deadly rays finally kill him, Ventanus will put a bolt through the word-bearer's skull. The last to die will be a word-bearer, slain by the hand of an ultramarine. This is not theoretical, purely practical. Chapter 2. Lanshear. Once counted among the great starports of Kalth, the city-sized facility burned in the fires of a legion's wrath. Hol Beloth and Fodral Fell were two names they knew, but there were others. Warriors whose deeds might once have echoed with honour in an earlier age, but which were now bywords for betrayal, mentioned in the same breath as Horus. Lanshear is a necropolis, a cemetery city whose streets are choked with scorched hulks of wrecked fighting machines, the planet-wide detritus of battle, and tens of thousands of radiation-blackened bodies. The lethal rays of Kalth's sun are burning their bones to ash, and irradiated winds blow flakes from the dead in swirling dust devils. Most are the mortal soldiery of the traitors, killed by the retribution of the orbital platforms, or poisoned by the sun when the last of the planet's atmosphere was stripped away. Only a scattered few corpses have the post-human scale of legionaries. Only enemy dead remain on the surface. The fallen of Kalth have been taken below and accorded the proper honour. Great siege excavators and mechanicum construction engines intended for wars of crusade are digging mortuary caverns throughout Kalth's bedrock, vast galleries and deep shafts where the honoured dead will forever be part of the world they die defending. Ingenium Subiaco's pioneers have much yet to accomplish, but honouring the dead was the first task Ventanus set them. Chapter 3. Torren's purging of enemy scrap code from the orbital defence grid saved Lanshear from complete destruction, but the thoroughness of her retribution left little standing after the beam weapons, missile stations and barrage platforms pounded the word-bearer's assault to dust. The shells of foundries and roofless manufactories spread over the blasted industrial hinterland like the ruins of some long-dead civilization. Forests of sagging tower cranes and the buckled remains of bulk lifter rigs list like drunks, and the railhead terminal of the Bedros Oblique is like a child's toy set of rolling stock scattered across the transit lines and engine hangars. Munitions depots and cargo containers, stockpiled in anticipation of being raised to orbit, burn throughout the starport, and hundreds of ink-black columns of smoke striate the rippling aurora of the sky. The crackle of flames and the screech metal sound of collapsing structures echo mournfully through gutted transport hulks and the wreckage of a world-conquering army. Ventanus remembers this place. He remembers the sheer violence, the never-ending blitz of enemy fire, the overwhelming force of it all, mass reactives in solid hurricanes, LAS sheeting like neon rain, and the thunder of traitor battle engines howling in bloody triumph. Explosions and screams merging to shape the death cry of an entire world. Compared to that, this nightmarish flame-lit vision of perdition is almost quiet. Lan Shear is dead. But there is yet activity. The distant foundries and cargo depots far to the north of the main fields are wreathed in a mist that is wholly unnatural, and fires burn there that are not the fires of devastation, but of construction and rebuilding. In the midst of this planetary cataclysm, something survives. Fragmentary Vox intercepts suggest Fodral Fell holds the northern foundries, but beyond that supposition, nothing more is known for certain. The aftermath of the battle for Kalth has left a great deal of theoretical, but precious little practical. Below the ridge where Ventanus and 200 legionaries of the Fourth are concealed, the rusted tracks leading from the burning railhead terminal run in arrow straight lines from the oblique to the foundry depots. "Can you see anything, sir?" asks Celaton, crawling up to join him at the edge of the ridge. Ventanus shakes his head. Whatever is happening in the north remains a mystery. "I need Vatian scouts," he says. "But..." He waves a hand, leaving the sentence hanging, and Celaton nods in understanding. During their desperate thrust towards the Guildhall, Vatian's pathfinders safely brought them into Landshear under the watchful gaze of the word-bearers. But their armour is too light to survive the hostile environment of the surface. Even Mark IV plate can only remain above ground for a limited time before its protective qualities are eroded. Terminators can move with impunity, but Ventanus has precious few of them at his disposal. "You really think the word-bearers will come this way?" asks Celaton, and Ventanus knows that the sergeant shares Sidance's belief that this is a theoretical without merit. "I do," says Ventanus, nodding towards the railhead terminal. Hundreds of locomotive convoys lie scattered like dead snakes throughout, their fuel tenders split and belching thick tarry smoke. "Why?" asks Celaton. "There are plenty more direct routes to the northern foundries, all of which involve crossing large tracts of open ground. Hit it at speed and they could be across before the orbital's got a solution. Without vehicles, would you risk it?" Celaton considers the question for a moment before answering. "Theoretical. If I was trapped on an enemy world with no immediate prospect of reinforcements, I'd want to link up with friendly forces as quickly as possible." "Practical. The railhead terminal offers cover," says Ventanus, gesturing to the building's shell-cratered roof. The covering is still largely intact, though shafts of wounded blue light spear through its smoke-fogged interior. Server Tyrant's Auspex feeds suggest that whoever's leading this force is cautious. He's moving from cover to cover, taking his time. "But she lost them," points out Celaton. "We don't know where they are now." "If he wants to reach Fodral Fell alive, he'll come this way," asserts Ventanus. "Did the server happen to mention anything about their numbers?" "At least 500, maybe more," replies Ventanus. "Then I hope you're right," says Celaton with relish. Chapter 4. They come in ragged squads at first, tentatively, like thieves in the darkness. Emerging from the gutted shell of a Titan repair facility, two groups of word-bearers emerge like wary, grazing beasts approaching a watering hole frequented by an apex predator. They move swiftly between the burning hulks of derailed shipping containers. Ventanus lets a finger slip beneath the trigger guard of his bolter. He lets out a breath. These are just scouting forces, probing thrusts into the flaming ruins of the edge of the terminus. They hope to provoke any potential ambushers into carelessness, but Ventanus has been specific in his orders. None of his warriors open fire, though each of them dearly wishes to. If this trap is to be sprung completely, then the word-bearers must fully stick their heads into the noose. Watching the enemy warriors, Ventanus sees the plate of their legionary armour has changed again. First it changed from granite grey to crimson. Now it is a mixture of scorched black, bare metal iron, and a few remaining patches of bruised blood. The first was a choice. But this latest change is not. The light of Kalth's wounded star has robbed the 17th Legion of uniformity, and Ventanus realizes he can no longer think of them as legionaries. They are too ragged, too individual, to be worthy of such a unifying term. They do not even deserve any force designation, such as company or battalion. This is a war band, a haphazard arrangement of survivors. Within the protective environment of his helmet, his lip curls in contempt. You won't be survivors for much longer. These forward elements of the word-bearers advance into the railhead terminal, still moving cautiously, still keeping one eye on the sky and the unseen orbital weapons. They pass out of sight, obscured by the banks of smoke, and Ventanus counts the long seconds in time with his heartbeat. He wonders if he's made a mistake. Perhaps the word-bearers have split into smaller groups, each one making its own way to Fodral Fell. He senses Seliton's scrutiny, but keeps his gaze fastened on the buckled tracks leading to the terminus. He wills the enemy to show itself. Then the real prize comes into view. A marching column of word-bearers emerges from the shelter of the repair facility, moving with as much speed as caution allows. Ventanus calculates their numbers to be close to 600. All infantry, no vehicle support and no dreadnoughts. A few light artillery pieces, but nothing that gives him pause or second thoughts. But it is more than their lack of heavy firepower that convinces him that this attack will work. Watching the exaggerated caution in their movements, Ventanus realizes that the word-bearers are in a state of shock. They came to Kalth, arrogant, confident of total victory. They forgot who they were fighting. That slip allowed the Ultramarines to deliver a stinging reprimand, the gut punch from a downed fighter that turns the bout on its head. Ventanus waits until he's sure that there are no more word-bearers yet to emerge from hiding. He rises to his feet and reaches behind him, hand outstretched. Another sergeant, Barker, hands Ventanus the standard, its half dented and the fabric of the company colours torn and ragged. He plants it at the edge of the ridge and pulls his bolter tight to his shoulder. "For Kalth!" he shouts, and 200 warriors of the Fourth rise up. Bolter fire blitzes down into the wreckage in front of the railhead terminus. The barking volley punches scores of word-bearers from their feet before they're even aware that they're under attack. A second volley kills dozens more. Now the enemy are moving into cover, returning fire and keeping their heads down. The Ultramarines do not advance, but hold their position, pouring fire into the enemy ranks. Ventanus is a keen-eyed shot and takes his time, picking his targets with care. He scans for officers and sergeants among the word-bearers. His task is made more difficult by the fact that the scorching of their warplate has obliterated most symbols of rank. In lieu of conventional markings, he targets those with the greatest disfigurements wrought upon their shoulder guards or helmets, the most heavily scarred, or those to whom others appear to defer. He puts a mass reactive through the helm of a warrior whose breastplate is hung with dagger-like fetishes, and whose mail cloak glitters with an oily sheen. He kills another with a jagged star symbol cut into the faceplate of his helm. A warrior with a long chain glaive and a crackling power claw dies with his chest blown out as he runs between two broken tenders. Any one of these kills would earn him a commendation for marksmanship, had anyone but him seen the shots. Ventanus feels the same rightness to these kills he felt as they first fought their way into Landshear. At this moment, his bolter is more than just a weapon. It is an instrument of just retribution, the nemesis of all that is faithless and treacherous. He ejects his emptied magazine and slots a fresh one home with smooth ease. A series of explosions bloom along the ridgeline, and the impacts hurl perhaps 20 Ultramarines to the ground. Ventanus recognizes the detonations of lightweight field artillery shells. Scavenged army weapons, not Legion ordnance. All the downed Ultramarines are quickly back on their feet and firing downhill with only a fractional pause in their killing. The word-bearers are shooting back, but their response is desultory at best. Some enemy warriors are not even bothering to return fire, and it takes Ventanus a moment to realize why. Seliton reaches the same conclusion a moment later. "They don't have enough ammunition to fight back," he says. The same realization is spreading amongst his warriors, and Ventanus feels their desire to take the fight to the Word-Bearers. They want to look the traitors in the eye as they kill them. They want to spill enemy blood with their own two hands. Like them, Ventanus wants to maglock his bolter and advance with his sword drawn, to teach Lorgar's faithless sons the cost of not finishing the job they started. He checks the thought. The theoretical is glorious, but this practical does not allow for emotion. "Hold position," he says. "Maintain fire." The tone of his voice is unequivocal and locks the ultramarines in place. The Word-Bearers are no longer shooting back. Instead, they're risking the relentless fire of the ultramarines as they run for the rail terminus. They have abandoned the field guns, knowing they're useless against warriors protected by power armor. Dozens of Word-Bearers are cut down as they cross the open ground, but hundreds more survive to reach the smoke-choked cover of the terminal. Thick smoke swallows them, and not even Ventanus's auto-senses can penetrate the Kemrich blackness. Celaton looks at him, waiting for him to give the order. Word-Bearers' bodies litter the ground. Some will still be alive, and Ventanus is glad. They will know what is coming. He opens a Voxlink on a prearranged frequency. "Server Torin, this is Ventanus. The enemy is in the kill box," he says. "You have a solution?"
"Affirmative," comes Torin's vox-distorted reply. "Engaging now." Her voice is without accent and apparently devoid of emotion, though Ventanus knows her well enough to know that is not true. He has come to like her, as much as any post-human can be said to like a chimeric, fully modified adept of the Martian priesthood. Celaton hears this exchange and turns his gaze upon the railhead terminus as the clouds light up with the approaching storm. A dazzling tower of light flashes from space, briefly linking an orbital lance battery with the surface of Kalth. The shell-punctured roof of the terminal lifts off in a rush of explosive kinetic force before vanishing in a cloud of fire. Ventanus does not flinch as the electromagnetic pulse and colossal overpressure wash over him. With one hand on the company's standard, he stands immobile as another lance strike pounds the railhead terminus, then another. Twice more, the orbital battery unleashes its power, and when the roiling banks of volcanic smoke are blown clear, nothing remains. The ground has been vitrified. Not so much as a single brick or nub of steelwork remains standing within a 500-meter radius of the first impact point. Ventanus nods in satisfaction and returns the standard to Sergeant Barker. He preempts Celaton's question of the lance strike's timing before it's asked. "Because I want the last sight of every Word-Bearer to be an ultramarine," says Ventanus. Chapter 5. The cave sit beneath a conurb ring on the southern transit hub of the Uranic Radial, a once populous region of vast habitation blocks 100 kilometers west of Landshear. Its hyperstructures and sprawling megatowers were toppled by the guns of warring titans in a firestorm like the coming of an apocalypse. Heedless of the terrified inhabitants, traitor engines and loyalist forces duelled in a battle that left hundreds of thousands of combatants dead, but saw no real victor, as each side's forces were drawn away to higher value objectives. The caves are a marvel, a series of naturally occurring subterranean voids that local legends attribute to the mythical serpent said to have honeycombed the bedrock of Kalth in the planet's prehistory. No one believes such things, not even children, but a new serpent has made its lair in the coiling tunnels beneath the Uranic Radial. His name is Hol Beloth, and once he commanded an army of annihilation, a genocidal host that sought not to conquer and enslave, but to destroy in the name of Horus. 500,000 warriors rallied to his banner. The barest fraction of that force remains. His army has been reduced to less than 10,000, and even this number is largely made up of the mangy rabble of the Brotherhoods, among them the Kaul Manduri, the Tzenvar Kaul, and the Giawanate and the Ushmeta Kaul. Bloodied and humbled, the predatory hosts of Hol Beloth take refuge in the Uranic Arcology, invisible to the murderous fire of the orbital batteries and sheltered from the deadly radiation scarring the surface, but tarred with failure. As falls from grace go, Hol Beloth's is all but complete. Hol Beloth is one of the Anointed Ones, a warlord of vaunted ambition and proven battle worth. He has led conquests on a thousand worlds, seen the fall of empires, and brought ruin to uncounted enemies. He is all this and more. But he fears that his dream of ascending to stand at the side of Lord Aurelian is slipping from his grasp. He still does not understand how they failed. The Ultramarines were broken, scattered and leaderless, within minutes of destruction. And then the heavens rained fire and killing light, gutting Titans with every hammer blow from orbit, and reducing entire war hosts to ash. Somehow, the enemy had regained control of the orbital batteries and turned what should have been his greatest triumph into his blackest defeat. Landshear was to burn in the thunder of Hal Beloth's guns, but the storm turned and tore the beating heart from his chest. He broods in a cave that echoes with the heartbeat of the dying world, with nothing but ashes for companionship. At his full height, Hal Beloth is a towering giant in crimson armor, his flesh cut with the words of Lorgar and inked in consecrated blood. But defeat has bowed him. He was chosen for great things, but failed to live up to his end of that bargain, and the forces that empowered him have forsaken his ambitions. For all Hal Beloth knows, his army may be the last alive on Kalth. His fellow commanders, do any of them yet live? Is Cor Pheron dead, or does he still fight to bring the word to Kalth? Hal Beloth has no answers, and the sense of loss is paralyzing him. The warp flask sits beside him, the oil-dark liquid stagnant and lifeless, where once it wriggled and slithered with the motion of something fetal and immeasurably ancient. He speaks to it, hoping to hear from his fellow commanders, but receives no reply. The thing that deigned to squeeze a fragment of its consciousness into that many-angled space is gone, and Hal Beloth has never felt more isolated. The Ultramarines control the few remaining satellites, and rad storms on the surface make a mockery of any attempt at encrypted vox. He looks up as he hears approaching footsteps, legionary footsteps. His mouth curls in a sneer as he sees Malok Kartho. The Dark Apostle filled his head with visions of power and majesty throughout the approach to Kalth and their campaign of extermination. Like all true zealots, he refuses to let their utter defeat diminish his passion. Hal Beloth wants to kill him, but when the knights come to Kalth, the muttering shadows still attend the Apostle like unseen flunkies. And in the caverns beneath Kalth, it is always night.
"What do you want?" demands Hal Beloth.
"To take the word to the Ultramarines," says Kartho, "as you should."
"You want a fight?" snaps Hal Beloth. "Go ahead, make your way to the surface and see how long it takes the orbital guns to end you."
Kartho is a bleak presence, similarly marked but thrice favoured. He has the blessing of the Primarch, the Empyrean, and the beasts from beyond the veil. His armour glistens as though freshly daubed with blood, and the runic inscriptions carved into every plate writhe in the azure bioluminescence of the cave. His helm bears a single horn at his right temple that curls around his head to an iron-sheathed point at his left cheek. At his back is a long staff, black-hafted and trailing smoky shadows that etch themselves upon the air. His face is angular, swathed in darkness, and hard to read. Hal Beloth suspects this to be deliberate artifice on Kartho's part.
"You think your work on Kalth is done, Beloth?" says the Dark Apostle. "Do you really believe your task was simply to fight a mortal war? The War Master and Lorgar Aurelian require you to do more than spill blood with bolt and blade. They require you to transform the canvas of the galaxy, to bring great truths to those who have been blinded by the Emperor's empty promises. You are an avatar of the New Age."
Anger touches Hal Beloth, and he rises from his torpor with one hand hovering near the hilt of his warblade, the other curled in a fist.
"You spoke those words before," he says, "when I marched at the head of an unstoppable army. They put fire into the hearts of all who heard them. But I understand their truth now. They are as hollow as a Colchisian promise, and just as meaningless."
Malok Kartho unhooks the spiked staff from his back, and Hal Beloth thinks for a moment he means to attack him. Instead, Kartho plants it into the ground, and the muttering shadows swell at his back. The staff's length is scrimshawed with catechisms and blessings copied from Lorgar's great book, and topped with a circular finial, the eight spines of the octed radiating from its centre.
"You are weak, Hol Beloth," says the Dark Apostle. "Weak and stupid. A petulant child who weeps and wails and gnashes his teeth the first instant his desires are thwarted."
Hol Beloth reaches for his sword, but before the blade is even half drawn, the dark smoke around Kartho's staff whips out to slap his hand from the hilt. Kartho is in front of him, an instant later, moving without seeming to move, as though the muttering shadows have borne him aloft. Hol Beloth takes a backward step, surrounded by a veil of darkness that ripples with undulant motion, like a slick of oil in the air. Shapes move within its depths, infinitesimal fragments of immense presences from beyond space and time, pressing at the meniscus that separates this reality from theirs. They have no form save that which he imprints upon them, a multitude of eyes, fanged mouths, and curving horns that manifest and fade as soon as he looks. They are hungry. They feel the beat of his heart and crave the taste of his lifeblood. He is powerless to stop them if they attack. Kartho steps in close, and the darkness parts before him. It wraps itself around him like a shroud, slithering over the curved surfaces of his warplate, its lightless form lingering at his back like an acolyte. The sight disgusts Hol Beloth.
"To think I anointed you and set your feet upon the path to glory," says the Dark Apostle with a disappointed shake of his head. "Lorgar brought us truth from the place where gods and mortals meet, but you do not see it. You are too ignorant to see it. You have a chance to leave your mortal shell behind and rise to glory. But your moment is passing with every second you spend in wretched self-pity."
Hol Beloth does not fully understand Kartho's words, but he feels the terror of everything he was promised, slipping beyond his reach, never to come again. He drops to one knee before the Dark Apostle, head bowed as a supplicant.
"Tell me what I must do," he says.
The notion of submitting to the Dark Apostle's designs is abhorrent to him, but now he knows he will say or do anything to hold on to his ambitions. So badly does he desire to stand at the side of Lorgar and Horus that he willingly begs for Kartho's scraps.
"The galaxy is changing, Hol Beloth," says the Dark Apostle. "The old ways are passing, and a new order is establishing itself. What was is no more, and what will be is just taking shape. Those who embrace that truth will prosper. Those who do not will perish."
"Tell me what I must do," he asks again. "What do the powers require of me?"
Kartho leans down, and his hooded eyes are alight with a passion only bloodshed ignites.
"Atrocity," says Kartho. "They require atrocity."
Chapter 6. Geologists once came from far distant corners of the Imperium to study the cavern arcologies of Kalth. Magi from the forges of Mars and the master masons of the Terran guilds marvelled at their self-sufficiency and remarked often on how seamlessly the artifice of man blended with the vagaries of natural formation. Horus himself once came to Kalth as Gilliman's honoured guest, though no one now remarks on that particular visit. Ingenium Subiaco pauses in his labours and wonders what those magi and masons would make of what has been done beneath Kalth's surface now. A tall man with a permanent stoop that comes from spending endless days bending over highly detailed schemata, the Ingenium's craggy face is crowned with a thinning crop of corn-coloured hair. A set of brass-rimmed goggles, complete with new spheric MIU and a full sensorium suite, is clamped to Subiaco's haunted face like some form of surgical device. In the fine tradition of the Ingenium from Kalth, he cultivates a long moustache with its ends waxed to points that curl over his florid cheeks. Long days and restless nights have given him an unkempt look, one at odds with his station as a senior Ingenium of the Kalth Pioneer Auxilia. A wave of tiredness washes through him, and his eyes flutter closed for an instant. But he quickly blinks them open,
He has too many nightmares in his sleep to wish for more in his waking hours.
Subiaco stifles a yawn and watches as yet another opening in the bedrock is gradually sealed up. This one is a dead tunnel that delves 1,000 meters from a lower branch cavern of Arcology X. The cartography drones that returned tell him the tunnel is a dead end, but the violence of the war has made accurate readings of the deep caverns next to impossible. A pulse of thought fades up a new spheric projection of the tunnel's dimensions before his eyes. Subiaco dials down the magnification to view its entirety. The tunnel is 5 meters wide and curves downwards in a gentle arc for another 300 meters, twisting through a series of sharp bends before arriving at a water-filled correctional cave. The deeper reaches of the tunnel are hazed with error signifiers. Subiaco wishes he had the time and manpower to map them with greater accuracy. The cavern in which he stands is filled with the tools of the Ingenium, blue and grey earth-moving machines, each with dozer blades tens of meters high, bulk crawlers with pneumatic arms capable of lifting a super-heavy battle engine with ease, drilling rigs with conical snouts, and a lone construction engine of the Mechanicum. The noise they make is cacophonous, and but for the aural baffles worked into the mechanism of his goggles, he would long since have been deafened. Hundreds of men and women of the Pioneer Auxilia are manoeuvring the last of the blast shutters into meters-deep caissons at the mouth of the tunnel, while lumbering tankers of permacrete stand ready. The Pioneers wear heavy, tear-resistant coveralls and bulky respirators, but toil without complaint in the heat, dust and gloom. They are bent to their labours with pride and determination. Subiaco understands that pride. It is Ultramarian to the core. To strive for excellence is the bare minimum expected of Lord Gilliman's people, and to be born in the 500 worlds is an honour and privilege that must be repaid every day. The world above is no more, but he and his pioneers will be builders of the world below. Subiaco watches the work with bloodshot eyes, but he needs offer no suggestions nor make any corrections. His subordinates know their craft, and his instructions are precise, needing no further explanation. Instead, he calls up a fuller rendition of Arcology X, smiling as he realizes that Captain Ventanus's hurried marking of a map has effectively renamed this cave complex forever. Thinking of Ventanus, Subiaco looks up as an ultramarine sergeant in a battle-damaged suit of power armor approaches him. He does not know this warrior, but the deep blue of his armor is heavily abraded across the breastplate and pauldrons with bullet impacts and blade scars. Only his helmet is unscathed, painted a fresh crimson that seems oddly fitting.
"Sergeant Ancreon," says Subiaco, optical filters reading the warrior's name beneath a patina of lasburns on his right shoulder guard. "Is there something I can do for you today?"
"How long until the tunnel is sealed?" asks the giant.
Ancreon's tone is brusque, but Subiaco understands his urgency. Subiaco calls up a host of data streams and sifts graphs of work completion sigils with haptic implants in his fingertips.
"The shutters will be in place momentarily. Once the integrity checks are complete, we spray the permacrete and I will implant the locking seal. All things being equal, the tunnel will be secure within the hour."
Ancreon nods, though he is clearly unhappy with the answer.
"You can't do it quicker," he asks.
"Not if you want an Ingenium mark on the work, no."
"Would more machines speed the process?"
"Of course, but we don't have any more machines," says Subiaco. "We're lucky to have the ones we've got."
"Clarify."
Subiaco waves a hand at the construction engines and earth-moving machinery, causing his holographic graphs to spin away.
"None of these machines should be here, Sergeant Ancreon. They were all due for orbital transit when the traitors attacked."
"So why are they here?"
"My understanding is that we have the word-bearers to thank for that."
"I'm not in the habit of thanking those bastards for anything," says Ancreon,
and Subiaco hurries to explain himself as the space marine exudes a looming threat.
"You misunderstand. The corruption they used to infect the orbital defense systems," says Subiaco, "it appears it caused a cumulative arithmetical overflow in the scheduling subroutines of a defense auxilia calculus logi, which saw these engines sit idle on the embarkation platforms while the rest of Kalth was being shipped into orbit. Lucky for us, eh?
Ancreon does not reply, and looks up as the last of the blast shutters is lowered into position with a heavy impact of metal on stone. A squad of riveters move into position, their whining guns securing the shutter in place. Sparks rain down from their work, and the permacrete hoses lift with a hiss of pneumatics.
"This would go quicker if we didn't have to seal off all these dead branches," observes Subiaco, projecting a holographic representation of the tunnel structure from the surface of his data slate. "For example, this tunnel terminates hundreds of kilometers from the nearest arcology or shelter. There's really no need to expend resources to seal it."
Ancreon takes a moment to study the gently rotating image.
"Did you find a source for the water in the chamber at the tunnel's end?" he asks.
"No, implying that it is an opening of negligible proportions."
"In other words, you don't know where the water is coming from."
"Not as such, but..."
"Captain Ventanus's orders are unambiguous," interrupts Ancreon. "Any tunnel, the termination of which cannot be confirmed absolutely, is to be sealed."
"Sergeant, you need to understand that only a very few of Kalth's cave systems are linked. The vast majority is spread through the planet's crust in splendid isolation."
"If Kalth is to survive, that's going to have to change," says Ancreon.
Chapter 7. Shelter CV-427, Praxor, sits 1,500 kilometres to the east of Landshear, a series of hardened bunkers and armaments storage facilities. It is designed to hold up to 100,000 fighting soldiers and a further 20,000 ancillary staff, together with 3 battalions of Defence Auxilia personnel. Its maximum occupancy is listed as 150,000 souls. In the wake of the 17th Legion's attack, it's currently home to over twice that number. Its enlarged caverns and deep constructions are nightmares of overcrowding. Yet there's little anger amongst its inhabitants, save that directed at the warriors of the Word-Bearers who have driven them here. This is to be expected. The gates of Praxor have been closed for nearly 2 weeks, and tens of thousands of refugees fleeing the war and the doomed sun's radioactive spasms have sought sanctuary within. The shelter's accommodation is beyond its capacity, and the security of a weapons storage facility requires that every individual be identified. Once a full inventory has been taken of human and weaponized resources, a detailed campaign of resistance and reconquest can be developed. Every entrance to the shelter, and there are many, has been sealed, some with permacrete shuttering and some with warriors bearing guns. Elements from 5 different companies of the Ultramarines are now based here, 567 legionaries. They do not guard the entrances to the arcology. They train, they rearm, they mount sorties onto the surface when word comes from Arcology X that enemy forces are nearby. The security of the gates falls to the Imperial Army, of which there are 16 separate regiments present locally, and Skitari elements swept into the arcology by the star's radiation. Command protocols and communications are still in disarray as the Mechanicum adepts try to mesh army vox systems with their own and those of the Legionis Astartes. Different systems, hundreds of encrypted networks, and trillions of code combinations have brought a special kind of hell to operational coordination. It is this that is giving Major Cadine a headache that is only getting worse. She and her squad of Cardae stormtroopers occupy one of the smaller routes to the surface, more accurately described as a sinkhole filled with hard scrabble that has been pulled apart by millennia of tectonic movement. It is, nevertheless, a passageway that connects the caverns below with the surface, and must be guarded. Temporary shuttering, sprayed with rat-proof sealant, allows unprotected humans to occupy the prefab guard post and barricades that watch for infiltrators from the surface. 20 soldiers occupy the position, battered, war-brutalized veterans who have seen their world torn apart and broken into pieces that can never be put back together. Major Cadine's men have fought the good fight, and only these 20 of her 700 remain. They fought at the Pasushne Bridge and held it long enough for the 86th Company of the Ultramarines to cross. Along the Marisine Highway, a 10,000-strong rabble of cultist scum chased them for 100 kilometres before they reached the regimental strongpoint set up at the Talanco arterial. Holbeloth's flanking forces, moving to encircle Landshear, were on the verge of forcing them to abandon the strongpoint. But then came the fiery rain from orbit, burning the word-bearers and their rabble to vapour ghosts. Leaving her company colours flying proud at Talanco, Major Cadine followed Colonel Rurik as he brought the scraps of their regiment to Praxor. Cadine knows she will never see the surface of Kalth, but hopes that some remnants of the enemy forces will try to fight their way into the shelter. She dislikes being underground, having discovered a mild claustrophobia, but she is a stormtrooper, and to acknowledge weakness is not in her nature. She sits in the guard post's single structure, a reinforced tin shack, with a vox caster and her unit stock of anti-radiation pills, ammo, food, and water. This is what has become of her once elite unit. She flinches as a squawk of interference barks from the speaker horn of the vox caster. "Bloody mechanicum," says her adjutant, Corporal Bartabes. He smacks the grey steel box with the heel of his palm. "Bloody bastards never get anything bloody right." "I thought they were supposed to have this fixed by now." "And you bloody believe that, Major?" says Bartabes, fishing a low stick from his pocket and lighting it with the ease of a professional. Oily smoke lifts from his mouth.
"I thought you quit," says Cadine.
"I survived the surface," replies Bartabes. "If that ain't killed me, these bloody won't. It's boredom that'll do for me first."
Cadine can't argue with his logic, and though she could order him to put it out, she won't. They've suffered too much in the last few weeks to deprive Bartabes of his advice. Besides, he's probably right. She shrugs, turning on her heel as she hears the rumble of an engine. A big engine, something industrial. She wonders if there's something wrong with the sealant or the shuttering that requires a pioneer work team. She doesn't feel any effects of surface radiation, but supposes that's probably why it's so dangerous.
"Now what's this bloody noise?"
wonders Bartabes, as a heavy industrial carrier lumbers around the corner. Its cargo compartment is draped with a blue tarpaulin, roped down and covering several objects, bulky and oblong in shape. Work tools? Engineering equipment?
"We expecting anyone?" asks Cadine.
"Not that they bloody told us," replies Bartabes, giving the vox another clout. "Not that we'd have heard on this piece of junk."
The driver's army, but she can't see his unit insignia. 30 men accompany the carrier, some riding shotgun on the running boards, some marching alongside. They look bored, and Cadine can sympathise. There's something ragged about these soldiers, but that's nothing unusual. Everyone looks a little ragged these days. But her soldier's instincts are telling her there's more to it than that.
"Find out what they want," says Cadine, lifting the vox horn. "I'll see if I can get some word from on high."
Bartabes nods and reluctantly stubs out his low stick. As he showed us his Hellgun, Cadine says,
"Eyes on."
Bartabes understands immediately, and his demeanour instantly changes. He leaves the guard post and waves four soldiers to accompany him, bulky in glossy plates of ablative carapace. Each stormtrooper wears the regimental insignia of crossed lances over a skull on one shoulder plate, a hand-painted black X on the other. With Bartabes at their head, they march out in front of the new arrivals. Bartabes waves his arms in front of him like a crew chief on a landing platform.
"Right, who the bloody hell are you?" he demands with his customary wit and charm. "This is a Cardace post."
A man in a uniform that hangs strangely on him detaches from the soldiers escorting the vehicle. He carries an old-style data slate and holds it out to Bartabes. He says something she can't hear. Cadine lifts the vox horn and twists the dial to the assigned command frequency. As she does so, her eyes alight on a man partially obscured by the tarpaulin-wrapped cupola of the cargo vehicle. He wears armour, but it takes her a fraction of a second to realise what's wrong with it. The man is dressed as a Cardace trooper, but she has never seen him before. Her mouth opens to shout a warning. A scream of dissonant noise erupts from the vox horn, a blast of a million terrorised screams that comes from a place of horror and blood. It paralyses her, literally paralyses her. Her every nerve is shrieking in pain, but she can't move. Something pours from the vox horn, a rush of stinking black fluid. It spatters the wall like an oil-filled balloon has just been thrown at it. She sees the men talking to Bartabys pull out flasks of black liquid and throw them to the ground. She can't move. Fluid shapes leap from the black oil. She still can't move. More glass breaks. More viscous darkness erupts like tarry geysers. Shifting, formless things of grasping arms, gaping mouths, and tearing claws slam into her soldiers and bear them to the ground. The rest of the men in her command drag their rifles to their shoulders, but there are shadows for them all. They slither over the floors, stretch and swell over the walls, and loom down from the cavern roof. Men are plucked from the ground, and black filth pours into their screaming mouths. It stops up their ears and noses, presses its way into their skulls through their eyes, and invades the entirety of their bodies in the space of a heartbeat. Cadine sees all of this, but she still can't move. Her entire body is shocked rigid by the squalling blast of nerve-paralyzing sonics. The Vox is laughing at her. The spatter of oil on the wall is pushing itself into a semblance of form, human but larger than any man she's ever seen. Bulked out beyond mortal norms, she recognizes the fluid-formed outline of Legion plate. The helmeted head has a horn that curls around it and is formed from glistening matter that stinks like a mass grave. It turns its gaze on her, and she wishes she could close her eyes. She wants nothing more than to shut this abhorrent monster away. The door to the guard post is thrown open. The man Bartabys was talking to enters. "They're all dead," he tells the horned black torso extruded from the wall. Behind him, Cadine sees her men being stripped of their armour and uniforms. The killers garb themselves in the colours of a regiment that, but for her, is now extinct. The dishonour is beyond insult. It is violation.
"You know where to take the device?" asks the monster, its voice a gurgling wet horror of liquid vowels and drowning consonants.
The man nods.
"The statue of Conor in Leprium. Rendezvous at 00:30.
Cadine wants so badly to reach down for her holstered las pistol. Sweat beads on her forehead. Her hand trembles, and incredibly, she feels a tingling sensation in her fingertips.
"Take 3 men and dump the corpses at least 5 kilometres out," says the black apparition. "The defenders must not learn what was taken until it's too late."
"It won't be long before a relief force turns up."
The black shape gurgles with what Cadine realizes with sick horror is laughter.
"You wear loyalist uniforms. Welcome them and share the camaraderie of brothers. Then kill them."
The black shape on the wall turns to her. A slit of a mouth forms in its impossible helm, a leering grin of anticipation. She feels warm leather at her fingers. The holster is open. She never keeps the press stud closed. Sweat pours down her face. Veins stand out. Her hand shakes as she slides it around the weapon's grip.
"Such gross betrayal of trust has power beyond measure," says the horned monster.
Cadine draws and fires her pistol with a scream of pain and grief. All she has already suffered and all she has just lost is distilled into this last act of defiance. She shoots the monster again and again. Her bolts burn it like a solder through plastic and ignite it like promethium. It burns away into a stinking mist. A sulphurous reek fills the guard post, the stench of voided bowels. She tries to turn her pistol on the mortal traitor, but the weapon is slapped from her hand. A rifle butt slams into the side of her face. Bone breaks, and she falls to the ground. Pain shoots around her body, and a gut-cramping nausea stabs through her paralysis. The traitor drops on top of her, one knee in the chest, another over her throat. He has a black-bladed knife in one hand, the tip scratching the surface of her eyeball. Fluid oozes out over her cornea. His palm rests on the dagger's pummel, ready to drive it home.
"Just for that, I think you're going to come with us," he says. "Be interesting to see what your new son does to one of its own."
Chapter 8. The heavy adamantium gates of Arcology X rumble closed on rollers the size of land raiders, blotting out the venomous blue light of the system star. Booming locks hammer home, shutting the subterranean complex off from the upper world. Thundering recycle units purge the contaminated dust from the vast airlock chamber. Remus Ventanus and the warriors of the Fourth Company stand immobile in the roaring winds as a Mechanicum adept and a host of servitors with hostile environment augmetics come forward with high-pressure hoses to scour them with electrolyzed water that runs into specially dug sluices. Ventanus has little patience for such processes, but with so many mortals packed into Arcology X, decontamination is a necessary evil of any mission to the surface. Celoton and Barker stand behind him, Barker still clutching the battered pole of the company standard that Ventanus retrieved from the slaughtered honor guard at the Numinous starport. Water drips from the Eagle and the Ultima, making both shine brightly in the gloom of the gateway. The symbolism pleases Ventanus and makes the time taken to cleanse their armor feel worthwhile. He could have the indentations of the dead warrior's grip worked out of the metal, but he will not. The dying grip of the ultramarine, whose name he never knew, will be a constant reminder of the word-bearer's betrayal. Wherever this standard ends its days, it will forever display the mark of its former bearer. With the closing of the gate and the completion of decontamination procedures, the defense protocols ease a fraction, and servitor-crewed turrets switch their macro weapons from armed to safe. An internal bulkhead the size of a jungle escarpment rumbles down into the floor with the sound of tectonic plates grinding together. The Mechanicum adept waves the ultramarines in and leads his servitors away. Ventanus marches from the decontamination barbican into Arcology X. Chapter 9. Captain Octavian Bruscius makes his way through the neatly arranged lines of beds and temporary shelters, housing the groups of civilian survivors, packed into CV-427 Praxor. Bruscius is a gene-forged post-human, and they are but mortals. Yet they are all warriors of Ultramar. He feels proud to number himself among them. He has fought in the Legion's battle lines for a century and a half, but fighting within the bounds of the 500 worlds is something he never expected. There has never officially been a theoretical for a war between the legions, and though Bruscius understands he is simply a line officer, even he recognizes that the Ultramarines will never be the same again. The War Master's treachery has upset the Order of the Galaxy, and nothing will ever be the same. He and his battle brothers of the 24th Company are based in Praxor, warriors from the 56th, 33rd, 111th, and 29th Companies are here too. His group is the largest, boasting 209 warriors, whereas the 111th has been reduced to a single squad. Cut off from the fighting, they are isolated beneath the tumbled ruins that are all that remains of the Persephis and Kayla Prefecture conurbs. Techmarine Colbia has established contact with 16 other nearby shelters, as well as Captain Ventanus in what is now known as Arcology X. Bruscius does not know why its name has been changed, and is just glad that Lord Gilliman saw fit to place Ventanus in control of the fight back. The word-bearers have taken the surface, but the war beneath belongs to the Ultramarines. Bruscius forces himself to keep such thoughts tamped down. He has more immediate concerns. Registration areas have been set up in each of the largest caverns, manned by the few administratum personnel who escaped below ground. It is a thankless duty, but the citizens of Kalth form snaking lines as they await their turn to be processed, without complaint. Well over 10,000 people are crammed into this cavern alone, with more pressing in behind. Motorized gurneys drive along cleared lanes between the queues, bearing reams of accumulating paperwork and identity confirmations from the registration booths. The drivers are all army-helmeted and with rifles slung across their backs. Bruscius and 20 of his warriors are here to oversee the registration process and watch for any security breaches, but his company will be rotated onto surface patrol soon. He recognizes the importance of this work, but Bruscius wants to kill word-bearers. His eyes roam over the thousands of people in the cavern, pleased to note the stoic determination on every face. These people have seen their world virtually destroyed, but there is no trace of panic or psychosis. They came with nothing but that which they could carry on their backs when the evacuation order came through, yet still stand proud and ready to serve. What other citizenry of the Imperium could rally so magnificently? Almost all are young. All are ragged and grimy, but no amount of dirt can hide the mottled purple radiation burns with which almost every man, woman and child's skin is afflicted. The Medicae call it the Mark of Kalth, and it is as much a badge of honour as it is an injury. Bruscius moves on, traversing the echoing cavern and counting the hours until he can turn his weapons on the enemy. Everywhere he goes, people turn to stare at him, and he finds the attention faintly discomforting. He is a warrior, pure and simple, yet these people invest him with all their hopes of a better tomorrow. It is a heavy burden to bear, one he had not known he shouldered until this moment. A woman with a babe in arms, clutched tight to her breast, approaches him, and she reaches out to touch his vambrace. Under normal circumstances, Bruscius would never allow such contact, but these are far from normal circumstances. Another two children hold tight to the hem of her skirt, both so young and fragile-looking that Bruscius finds it hard to believe they survived the horrors above.
"Emperor, protect you," she says.
Bruscius does not know how to respond and gives the woman a nod. She smiles, and he knows she will treasure the memory for the rest of her days. The Ultramarines have become touchstones of hope, living proof that Kalth will rise again, that its people will one day reclaim what was taken from them. It has been a humbling experience and a salient reminder of why the Great Crusade was fought in the first place. The woman holds out her hand, and Bruscius sees a small Aquila pendant on a silver chain lying flat against her palm.
"Take it," she says. "Please, you have to."
The Ultramarines have standing orders not to accept gifts from civilians. Despite that, their muster spaces and arming points are surrounded by offerings, tokens of gratitude, and handwritten messages declaring a readiness to fight for Kalth.
"My thanks, but it is not permitted," he says, turning away to move on.
"Please," says the woman more insistently. "She needs you to have it."
Something in the woman's tone makes him stop and turn back to her.
"Who needs me to have it?" he asks.
The woman tilts her head to the side, as though confused at his question.
"The saint," she says, almost in tears. "You need to see, before it's too late."
Bruscius finds himself reaching for the Aquila, though he knows he should not. The woman sighs as though a pent-up breath has just been expelled from her lungs. She looks up at him, and though Bruscius does not easily recognize conventional human expressions, he sees she is surprised to find herself face to face with a space marine. As his hand closes on the silver pendant, combat reactions surge within his post-human body as chem shunts within his battle armor flood his system with combat stims in expectation of battle. His bolter snaps up, and his visor is suddenly overlaid with tactical schemata, spatial signifiers, and topographical data. A vox link instantly activates between him and his battle brothers. Bruscius has no idea what has triggered this reaction, and the woman backs away from him in fear as he goes from heroic savior to lethal, bioengineered killer in the blink of an eye. He scans for any sign of threat and immediately sees the motorized gurney bearing boxes of administrative documents and the like. Two things are immediately obvious. First, the gurney is laden with heavy boxes, but is heading towards the registration booths. Second, its driver wears army fatigues, but they're ill-fitting and clearly not his own. Bruscius sets off at a run towards the gurney, bellowing for people to get out of his way as a terrible foreboding fills him. The driver sees him coming and grins with zealous fury as he halts the gurney in the centre of the cavern. Bruscius pulls his bolt gun tight to his shoulder. A targeting reticule fastens on the man's centre mass. It flashes red in full expectation of a lethal shot. The man stands and shouts at the top of his voice, with his rifle and a black-bladed dagger held aloft.
"Hear the word of Lorgar!"
It is all he manages, before Bruscius's mass reactive blows out his chest and entire upper body in a wet meat explosion. People duck for cover, clearing a path for Bruscius as his warriors close on his position.
"Get back!"
shouts Bruscius, kicking the dead man's remains from the driver's seat and hauling boxes from the back of the gurney. As he feared, they were concealment for something hidden behind them, a long, crudely machined tube of thick metal, sealed at both ends by seamed welds and pierced by a multitude of sheathed connection jacks, electrical buffers, and decoy wires. Behind a crystal flex panel, Bruscius sees a pair of brushed steel casings marked with the symbols of his legion. His armour registers a blazing spike of radiation, but it is the only warning Bruscius gets. The stolen atomics detonate a second later, filling the cavern with nuclear fire that spreads through the entirety of shelter CV-427 Praxor and kills every living soul within. It is the first of three such atrocities that murder 2 million civilians in one night.